Kijakazi.
I'm here.
All right. Mr. Janich.
Hello.
Can you hear me, Mr. Janich?
I can hear you.
Okay.
Can you hear me?
Yes. So just looks like we have you on video and Mr. Burdett here in court. So
excellent. Thank you.
If you are ready to proceed, you may begin.
May it please the court. My name is Eitan Kasteljanich, and I am representing Gabrielle Craner in this appeal. Gabrielle Craner has been unable to work for many years due to the combined functional effects of many impairments, including post-traumatic stress disorder, depression, and anxiety, which ultimately led to her also developing a very severe polysubstance abuse problem. In fact, the ALJ found that the combined functional effects of all of Craner's impairments, including the polysubstance abuse, met listing 12.15, which is the listing that applies to post-traumatic stress disorder. But the ALJ also found that in the absence of the effects of Craner's polysubstance abuse, she did not meet that listing and she would be able to work. We dispute that part of the ALJ's analysis. The ALJ improperly rejected the opinions of Craner's treating psychologist, Dr. Molly O'Neill, who opined that Craner's overall mental health symptoms are currently severe. And she said this many times, and she saw and treated Craner many times.
Is there anything in Dr. O'Neill's opinion which specifically addresses what your client's limitations would have been absent the substance abuse issues?
Well, throughout the time frame that she was treating Ms. Craner was clean and sober. She had a relapse, but for the most part, she was clean and sober. She was on methadone treatment.
Well,
she was living in clean and sober housing.
I'm looking at, on that point, the records show a lot of substance abuse in the records of your client in the 2017 period. Heroin in late 2017, methamphetamine in late 17, etc. But putting that aside, my question was, is there anything where Dr. O'Neill specifically, who has diagnosed your client with the substance abuse issues, as you said, is there anything in her opinion that specifically says, here is the residual functional capacity, the ability to work of your client if she didn't have a substance abuse problem, that if she didn't have a substance abuse problem, she still couldn't do any relevant work? Is there anything like that in Dr. O'Neill's opinion, anything explicit?
No, there is not, because throughout the time frame that Dr. O'Neill was treating her, she wasn't using she was clean and sober for almost that entire period, massive treatments.
I don't see how you can say that. I mean, counsel, I'm looking, for example, at, and I think I have the record sites, 316, which says, as a diagnostic impression, heroin use from August of 2017, heroin use disorder severe, methamphetamine use disorder severe, last heroin use July 2017, last methamphetamine use August 2017. There's other parts of the record that show October of 2017 and December of 2017 for heroin and methamphetamine use. So how can you say that the record shows that she was clean and sober during this entire period or much of it?
Well, I think we need to be clear on what period we're talking about here. She filed for benefits as far back, you know, alleging disability, since December of 2009. And there's very little evidence that goes back to there. And during that entire time frame, she was clearly abusing all sorts of substances. So there's no clear way to prove how she would have been doing during that time frame if she had not been abusing substances. That was she was using them constantly. Her application for SSI was filed in August of 2017. And there is a change in her behavior. And it wasn't one day she was using and the next day she was clean and sober, because she was slipping back and forth initially. But ultimately, she ended up in a clean and sober housing and in ongoing intensive therapy and treatment, where she was having to go one day a week for a full day of treatment and several other days a week for counseling, and also going to substance abuse counseling. So she was, she finally was dealing with this and dealing with it rather successfully. And so really, when I talk about Dr. O'Neill's, the evidence from her and what she was her description of what she was seeing, it is during a time period in which Craner was transitioning from being a severe drug abuser, a drug addict, to being clean and sober and recovering her life. And so the final, the thing is, what you have to look at is the last couple of times that Dr. O'Neill stated an opinion about how severe she severely impaired she still was. She was almost entirely clean and sober then. She'd had one relapse.
So, Mr. Janich,
can I interrupt?
Yes.
This is Judge Fletcher speaking. Can you help me with the timeline in the following sense? When's her last eligible date? That is to say, I understand the timeline you've just given me in terms of when she was addicted, and then when in sort of mid to slightly late 2017 she becomes clean. Does she have to be disabled before that date, the time she becomes clean, in order to be eligible? Help me out with that.
Well, there's two separate eligibility issues here. One is Social Security disability. One is SSI. And honestly, the Social Security, it is arguable that she's been disabled by the combination since as far back as 2009. But there is not any kind of way. It's awful difficult to determine that from 2009 to 2017, were no periods of sobriety.
You just told me that there were two dates that were relevant, but you didn't give me either date. What are those dates?
Well, one of the dates is December 31st, 2009. For whatever reason, that's her alleged onset date in her application. I think that's based on perhaps the last day she could have been eligible for Title II disability benefits. I think the more pertinent date here is August of 2017, when she applied for SSI. Because although she was not clean and sober, or fully clean and sober at that point, over the ensuing months, she began maintaining sobriety, and there was no significant difference between her limitations when she, in say August 2017, and then over the next several years when she was maintaining sobriety but continuing to be substantially impaired.
I've got an embarrassing question, embarrassing for me, not for you. Help me understand the distinction between disability and SSI and how that plays out here.
Well, the only way she could get Social Security disability is by proving that she's been unable to do any kind of work without considering, you know, removing the factor of drug abuse and alcoholism since prior to her date last insured. And I don't even have that written here, but she's at least alleged, I wouldn't be surprised if it's December 31st, 2009. With SSI disability, it's different. You just have to show that you're unable to work. And in this case, the judge, the ALJ, found she was unable to work since her application date. Well, it's not real clear when he says he found this, but certainly he did find that she was disabled when you considered, took into account the effects of her mental illness and the effects of her substance abuse together. So the question then is, well, if you can remove the effects of the substance abuse from the analysis, was she still disabled? And that's awful hard to do if the person never maintains any level of sobriety. But once Craner started maintaining sobriety in 2017, 2018, 2019, it became evident that even sober, she was still impacted to the point that she could not work a full-time job. Now, she was not as impaired.
That clearly is not what the finding of the ALJ was. I mean,
you're right.
I mean, that's obviously why you're appealing. But that that clearly is not what the ALJ said. And I have trouble seeing how the ALJ's determinations in this regard aren't supported by substantial evidence. The ALJ talks about some of the things that your client was able to do. The ALJ talks about, and I think this even goes with what you're saying, improved functioning when she started weaning herself from drugs. And the ALJ said that based on the evidence, including her improvement, that absent the substance abuse, there would be jobs that she would be able to do. And I don't see any treating physician who even said, absent substance abuse, this is what she could do. So I have trouble seeing how we can reverse the ALJ given the very deferential standard of review.
Well, I'll say this again. The two last evaluations by Dr. O'Neill were both during time periods where Craner was fully clean and sober, and she wrote in her statements that Craner was still severely impaired by her mental illness. But in fairness, Dr. O'Neill did not specify specific functional limitations, which is why I then refer to Dr. Wingate's evaluation. She specified specific functional impairments, and she specified them described them during time periods in which Craner was clean and sober. She did this once in, her second evaluation was not considered by the ALJ. It was submitted to the appeals council, but it was dated just prior to the ALJ's decision. But in both of those evaluations, she opined that Craner had marked limitations in a number of key areas. And there's no reason, the ALJ didn't state any valid reason for rejecting Dr. Wingate's opinion.
Counsel, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
I'm looking at the 2019 reference that you're talking about. And it seems to me to be, given the standard of review, consistent with what the ALJ found. I mean, the 2019 where you're saying she's clean and sober, it says she's taking public transportation, she manages her finances, she does grocery shopping, she cooks again now that her children is with her, she has appointments with counselors and gets methadone twice a week, she attends class, she gets her children to school in the morning. Why aren't those kinds of findings, when you're saying she's clean and sober, fully consistent with the ALJ's findings about what she would be able to do were she completely weaned from drugs?
Because the ALJ was not including in his residual functional capacity assessment the fact that she also needed to spend an entire day every week in intensive outpatient treatment in order to treat her her combination of mental illness and addiction. And she also was having to attend several appointments a week. That became the issues, their vocational issues that would have impacted her and affected her ability to perform full-time competitive work. The other thing is the ALJ's...
Can I ask you about that? Because you do argue that the ALJ erred in not including in the RFC assessment Ms. Craner's need to attend many of the counseling programs or counseling appointments every week. I guess can you describe for us the duration and frequency of these appointments as reflected in the record? And then my additional question, is there record evidence showing that Ms. Craner must attend these counseling sessions during the day or during the work week?
Well, Dr. O'Neill refers to all of the counseling sessions that she was holding for her, but also refers to the, and Dr. Whitney as well, refers to the intensive outpatient that she was attending for a full day. Her testimony also described having to do that. And a full day, once again, she would have been able to probably work part-time at some point as things had developed there. But Social Security defines work as the ability to perform a job 8 hours a day, 5 days a week on a consistent basis. And a person who's attending a full day of counseling every week because it's the only way they can maintain sobriety and maintain their mental health functioning, obviously is not going to be able, and the vocational expert testified that a limitation on missing just one day, more than one day per month, would eliminate all competitive work. I'm out of time, so unless you've got questions.
May I follow
ahead.
Up?
Yes, of course.
I may have missed it, but I didn't hear your answer to, or I didn't hear an answer to Chief Judge Murguia's question about whether there is record evidence that suggested that the one day a week that you're talking about had to be on a weekday, for example, or couldn't be fit around a separate 5 day a week schedule. Was there anything in the record that said that this day had to be on a day which would have prevented her from having a 5 day a week job? Any record page number or page numbers you can point to saying that?
I'm not aware of such evidence that it had to be on a weekday. No.
If I can take you just a moment over time, assume for a moment that the only way that she can do this intensive counseling, the all day period plus the other counseling, assuming that that does interfere with her ability to engage in full-time work. Why is not this therapy that's necessitated, why doesn't that qualify as drug related such that she doesn't get excused because of it?
Because the drug abuse and alcohol regulations talk about the effects of actually, you have to be actively using drugs or alcohol for it to be then counted against you, so to speak. If as an example, you abusing drugs and alcohol for decades, and you now are so terribly impaired that you can't function, even though you're now clean and sober, the DANA former use does not disqualify you. And I think this is like that.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
I get the answer. Okay. Thank you.
I do though want to address that the issue here, it's not just that she had to go to the counseling for the full day. The ALJ got facts wrong about for example, attending college, where she tried to attend college and had to drop out. I mean, there's some factual errors there. She was functioning in society, but she wasn't functioning to the point where she could have handled the stress of competitive work.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Janich.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. I'm David Burdett, representing the appellee, Dr. Kilolo Kijikazi, the acting commissioner.
Can you speak up a little bit? I don't know if there's anything we can do with the
volume.
I'm
sorry.
Or
can
if you,
can you hear me now?
Yeah, yes, that's better.
I'll try to be closer to the mic.
Thank you.
Before I begin with the substance, I want to answer one thing, if I could, that Judge Fletcher brought up. And I think that the distinctions are familiar to the Court, but just for the context, I think this will be fruitful. As we know, Title II disability insurance benefits are based on quarters of work that a person has worked during their life, and they accrue certain quarters of coverage, and they must be disabled prior to their date last insured in order to be eligible for Title II disability, what Mr. Janich was referring to as Social Security disability. The date for Ms. Cranor in this case of last insurance was December 31st of 2014. then it's a concurrent case, meaning it's also an application under both Title II and Title 16 of the Social Security Act. Title 16 is Supplemental Security Insurance, SSI. And that is the one where the number of quarters of work that you have performed is not relevant. It's based on your ability to work or not work as of the month of your application. That was the one. So that one is August 1st of 2017. So those are the dates, and that may be responsive to what Judge Fletcher was questioning earlier.
Yeah, that's helpful.
Okay. So now going ahead, Judge Bennett is correct that Dr. O'Neill's statement did not address any specific limitations that the claimant, Ms. Cranor, would have absent DAA, absent her drug abuse and alcoholism. And Mr. Janich has made a big deal, both in the briefing and argument, of saying that Dr. O'Neill said that she would have severe impairments. We agreed that she would have severe impairments, that the appellant, Ms. Cranor, would have severe impairments, whether or not she was abusing drugs and alcohol. That is certainly the case. The ALJ agreed with that. To be a severe impairment is not necessarily to be a disabling impairment. The ALJ agreed at page 28 of the record that without drug abuse and alcoholism, DAA as we abbreviate it, without DAA, the claimant would still be limited to only occasional and superficial interaction with the general public, jobs that impose no tandem or teamwork, and few workplace changes because of her history of and her ongoing anxiety, depression, and PTSD. And those are related to things that have, that she's had those conditions throughout her life. And they have been concurrent with her abusing drugs and alcohol. Now, what the ALJ has to make a finding about, though, is what would she be able to do with that kind of limitation were she not abusing drugs and alcohol? And the ALJ queried the vocational expert. The vocational expert, based on those limitations, came up with sample jobs. And there really is not any evidence that, for example, the scheduling... Go ahead, Judge McGee.
Sorry,
I see you have
a
question.
Let's just pick up where kind of left off a little bit with Mr. Janich, because you just kind of, I think, summarized the question for the vocational expert. But I'm not sure that it included the number or, of hours that she would need to go for counseling, which seems rather intense, understandably, in light of what you just described her severe impairments to be, whether with, when you consider the DAA or not. And so I'm trying to figure out if that was problematic, if it didn't include that amount of time in factoring in what job she could do. Can you respond to that?
I say it's not problematic, Your Honor.
Okay. Tell me why. Was problematic but harmless, or do you think it's not problematic at all?
To be serious, I think it's not problematic because there isn't evidence as to whether that counseling session, that supposedly one whole day of counseling, has to be during the work week. Now, Mr. Janich is correct that when we speak of work for Social Security, we're ordinarily talking about full-time work, 5 times 8, 5 days a week, 8 hours a day, or the equivalent. That's full-time work. And we can't make a finding that a person can work if they can't do that amount of work. But it doesn't have to be Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. It can be any days of the week and any hour shifts of the day that amount to those hours.
Following up on this, the ALJ noted at ER 23 that claimant attends 4 counseling sessions a week as well as addiction classes and AA meetings. Was there any testimony or record evidence that you're aware of that before the ALJ that there is a full day she needs to attend, what day of the week that would have to be at, or did anyone testify or post questions to the VE that would any of this interfere with her ability to have a full-time job?
I don't think so. I think the answer is no, Your Honor.
I don't recall it, but the fact that I don't recall it doesn't mean it's not there.
Yeah, I don't think it is there. I don't think it is there. I know Mr. Yonich will correct me if it's there, but I don't think that's there.
And if it's not there in terms of in the record evidence, we can't extrapolate how much that would be or anything like that.
No, we cannot at this stage read that into the guess as to what that is on the record. No, Your Honor, I don't believe that you can.
I think the only thing that I can remember from the record, I think, is that the AA meetings were at night.
Your Honor, I don't even want to hazard a guess about that. I don't remember that. I know that they often are, but I don't know that, and I don't want to put it in the record if it isn't there.
Let's talk about the ALJ's reference to daily activities of Ms. Craner that the ALJ found inconsistent, I guess, with Ms. Craner's testimony. I'm trying to figure out, because we have case law all over the place with respect to daily activities.
There certainly is. Yes, there's a ton of it, and it cuts all ways.
And it's hard because I'm trying to figure out what were the facts in those cases, and it seems like it's a very fact-intensive analysis. And I'm trying to figure out, are you arguing that any of those activities involve transferable work skills?
No, Your Honor, we're just, no. The answer is no.
And so if it's not, then we have to try to figure out if these were, if this was sufficient or, you know, evidence here to support the ALJ's determination. So why don't you talk to me about that and why you think it is supportable?
Thank you, Your Honor. So the answer is no, we're not arguing that those activities transfer to a certain set of work skills or that this activity means a certain work skill. The answer is that the activities are incompatible with the claim that absent DAA, she would be disabled by certain limitations. So they're incompatible with the claim that she has a certain degree of limitation. For example, if she is, and this is in particular the big claim, is that she's not able to be around people. And that the ALJ, I'm generalizing that, but the big claim is that she's disabled by an inability to work around people because of her anxiety and PTSD. And the ALJ bought that to a degree. She has a severe impairment that limited her, as we discussed a minute ago. But several of these activities involve her in being around people quite a lot. Taking the train, you go to the train station, you ride on the train. Going to the gym 5 days a week. Going over and working with her neighbor on gardening. Going to the casino, repeatedly going to the casino, frequently going to the casino, as the ALJ inferred. These are not isolated activities. These are activities that involve a lot of contact with the social world. And there is no question that she was going to the gym 5 days a week from 2017. There's no question that she was going, and although Mr. Yonich disputes this, there's really no question that she was going to the casino on a regular basis.
And so your argument, this case is different from the other cases in which we or this court has concluded that the mere fact that a plaintiff has carried basic daily activities does not in any way ability as to her overall disability.
Correct.
But you are saying that the ALJ, there's substantial evidence supporting the ALJ's determination that her undisputed actual daily activities are inconsistent with her description of some of her limitations.
Yes, Your Honor. They're inconsistent with her claims, with her description of some of her limitations. That's the argument with respect to activities of daily living. Now, I would like to get on, and I'll answer any more questions that the panel has about the activities of daily living. But I would like to get on to one thing that is a little bit different about this case from some other Social Security cases. It's a Brews case, meaning it's in the posture of this court's decision in Brews, where a late piece of evidence, not not late against the rules, but a piece of evidence was submitted to the Appeals Council that the ALJ did not have the opportunity to review. And that's Dr. Wingate's 2019 opinion. And we have to say, we have to establish that the ALJ's decision is supported by substantial evidence, even when you review the record that includes the Dr. Wingate opinion that was submitted to the Appeals Council. And in this case, I think that we do have that because Dr. Wingate's 2019 opinion that was only submitted to the Appeals Council, of course the ALJ didn't have the opportunity to review it. But the ALJ did review the 2017 opinion of Dr. Wingate. And if you look at those opinions side by side, Dr. Wingate checks the same boxes in 2017 as in 2019 with regard to the claimant's marked limitations, in her opinion, marked limitations. And so the ALJ's remarks with regard to the one apply equally with regard to the other. That, to me, is the point on which this decision stands. And I've basically laid out the position on it for us, is that the ALJ's remarks with regard to the 2017 opinion also suffice with regard to the 2019 opinion. Other than that, I would just like to make the point that Dr. O'Neill, as Judge Bennett noted in his questioning, really did not make any specific findings as to Cranor's vocational limitations at all. We really don't have that much of a problem with Dr. O'Neill's opinion. She doesn't put in the record any vocational limitations that would prevent Cranor from doing the work that the ALJ assigned to her with his residual functional capacity findings. And finally, I would like to just keep in the court's mind that this court has said as far back as 2007 that with regard to the materiality of DAA to a claimant's disability, which is the case that we have here, the claimant is disabled when her DAA, her drug abuse and alcoholism, is included in the set of limitations. But that's material. And when it's material, of course, she's not eligible. The claimant at all times bears the burden of proving that her disability was not material. And this court said that in Parra versus Astru in 2007, and that's the rule. And we don't believe that she's met that here. Can I answer any other questions from the panel?
No, thank you. Thank you very much, Mr. Burdett. Mr. Yonish, you ran out of your time. I'll give you 1 minute.
I'm unmuted. Okay, I want to adjust a couple things quickly. First of all, the key evidence that supports disability here are the evaluations by Dr. Wingate, both the one in 2017 and then the fact that in 2019, she basically said that she was continuing to be unable to handle the stress of a normal work environment. The issue as far as did the ALJ properly reject that evidence, the ALJ only stated that her opinion was not supported by evidence of Cranor's activities, and supposedly it was her depression and anxiety appear to be due in large part to situational stressors related to her children. Those are the ALJ's only two reasons for rejecting Dr. Wingate's opinion. Those reasons are not sufficient. The other thing is that with regard to her testimony about her functioning, she testified about trying to ride the bus and having to get off the bus when there were too many people on it, couldn't even go to her destination. She testified about not being able, she'd be around more than four people. She'd have to leave, stand by the door at AA meetings and leave because she couldn't handle being around everyone, but she went to them anyway because she needed to. She knew it. This is a woman who's fought back from horrible, horrible, horrible experiences as a child and is almost back, but she's not back yet. That's the issue here. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Yonish and Mr. Burdett, for your very interesting presentations here today. The case of Gabrielle Cranor versus Akilio Kijakazi is submitted, and that concludes our oral argument calendar and our docket for today. Thank you very much. We'll be adjourned.